Welcome to episode 2 of the Olasky Interview, brought to you by listener-supported World Radio. I'm your host, Jill Nelson. Today we have another interview from the World Vault. It's Marvin Olasky's 2012 conversation with author and speaker Arthur Brooks. Last year, Brooks stepped down as president of the American Enterprise Institute, a public policy think tank in Washington, D.C. Before that 10-year stint at AEI, he was a professional musician and a professor at Syracuse University. Today, he's a professor of the practice of public leadership at Harvard Business School. Here now to talk about this interview is World's Marvin Olasky. Marvin, welcome.
Hi, Joe. Good to be with you.
Well, you've had a chance to get to know Brooks over the years. How would you describe him?
Wow, he's both a nerd and a really cool guy. It's a strange combination of skills, playing the French horn in Barcelona, then becoming a professorial number cruncher, then a think tank executive. Who has careers like that?
Now, Brooks writes about how the welfare system is hurting the people it's supposed to help. And this is something you researched at the street level and wrote about back in the 80s. Is this what made you interested in Brooks' work, or were there other factors in play?
That's really a crucial point. As long as Republicans or conservatives were complaining about the welfare system and saying, well, it costs too much or this or that, that didn't get a whole lot of traction. Because the real problem with the welfare system is, as Arthur points out, and as I pointed out, it hurts the people it's supposed to help. In fact, once Arthur was talking with President Obama, and the president's jaw dropped when Arthur told him, the reason I'm a conservative is because poverty is what I care about the most. He didn't expect that. He expected to talk about the amount of money. But no, the real problem is the way it ruins so many lives.
You touch on a lot of topics in this interview, everything from the source of true happiness to how to best help the struggling single mom. What stood out to you in this interview?
What stood out to me was the way in which, while Arthur and I have very different methodologies, we came to the same conclusions. He's a number cruncher. He does lots of things with surveys, big statistics. I tend to be a storyteller, talk with people, interview people, poor people, homeless guys, stuff like that, and try to explain what's going on in their lives. So two very different approaches. He has the macro, I have the micro, and amazingly enough, they really jived. They came together. We both came to these conclusions that the biggest problem with poverty fighting right now is that it doesn't work, and the reason it doesn't work is because it doesn't bring challenging personal and spiritual help to people.
So you both came to similar conclusions about poverty. Are there any finer points you disagree with?
He may be a little bit more willing to see governmental action in certain areas than I tend to be. I've become very, very skeptical about almost any governmental action because I've seen so often that it backfires. The point he really makes that's important, and he expressed it much better than I have, is the significance of what he calls earned success. And this is a problem both with trust fund kids who inherit money or welfare kids who don't see their parents actually working and earning success. Earned success gives us not only the financial benefits of that success, but the understanding they were really needed. I've seen so often and talked with fathers of children who worked hard, and then at a certain point, they concluded that the kids were going to be as well off materially with the government as their dad than with the father actually in the house and serving as a dad. It was a wrong conclusion, but what often happens in that situation is the father wonders, why should I be working so hard to do this? It's not really benefiting my family. It's not making a difference in my kids' lives. And you see, in that situation, a lot of fathers just slink away, figuring, why bother? And it's a tragedy in our society. Let me just mention one other thing, that the Bible teaches us that the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. So what Arthur and I both understand is when we say to poor people, well, we don't expect you to work, we don't expect you to get married, forming families, then we're really treating these people made in God's image as inferior. And that's cruel to them, and it does not help the United States.
Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief at World. Marvin, thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Jill.
The Olasky Interview is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Crown and Covenant Publications, publisher of the new book, God Breathed, by Rutt Etheridge III. Connecting Through Scripture to God, Others, the Natural World, and Yourself. Available at crownandcovenant.com and on audiobook platforms.
Here now is Marvin Olasky's interview with author and speaker Arthur Brooks. This interview took place at Patrick Henry College in 2012. So when you hear Marvin refer to Brooks's new book, he's talking about The Road to Freedom.
How many French hornists from the Annapolis Brass Quintet and the Barcelona Orchestra have become presidents of the American Enterprise Institute?
One.
One. What are the similarities between French horn playing and being president of AEI?
It turns out that all of the, and this is the, one of the great things about the free enterprise system, is that you can learn things like this, that the, all of the things I liked about the music business, I still do. Sort of the creativity, the working out of ideas that are of interest to other people, and having audiences, and the privilege of having audiences to enjoy your work, are the same between what you do when you write books, what you do when you teach at the university, what you do when you're working in the music business. Of course, some of the fungibility of creativity, the marketplace of ideas, is something that you can only explore when you have an economy that allows you to pursue your own happiness. What effectively places, the only barriers that are placed in front of you are the barriers imposed by your own imagination.
So you write in your new book that when you told your dad that you were moving from a very good, settled, illustrious position in an orchestra playing the French horn into going to graduate school and so forth, and you posed it in terms of happiness, what was his response?
Yeah, so I had been playing for a long time, and I was playing in an orchestra, and things were going well, and I was supporting my family, and I wasn't happy. I didn't like it. I wanted to stop. What I really wanted to be was an economist. It's really weird, I know. I wanted to study, and I had been reading books by these economists and these social scientists at a place I'd never heard of before. It was a think tank called the American Enterprise Institute, interestingly. I was completely inspired by this. I said, I want to do this analysis that looks at how the gears turn in society, and I want to learn how to do this statistical and political analysis. And so I decided to leave music and go back to school. I hadn't even gone to college, as a matter of fact. I didn't go to college until I was 28 years old. And I was going to go back to college, and then I was going to get a graduate degree, and I was going to become a social scientist, this brand new plan. So I called up my dad. My dad was a college professor at a little liberal arts college in Seattle. And I said, Dad, I want to change careers. I want to become an economist. I want to get a PhD like you. And he sort of silenced, and he said, why do you want to do that? I mean, you're at the top of your career. You're supporting your family. I said, because I'm not happy. There's sort of a silence in the line. He said, what makes you so special?
One other part about your background, some students take out enormous loans with the goal of going to the most prestigious colleges or the most prestigious places to get master's degrees and so forth. I think you've done pretty well without actually going down that path. And tell us about the correspondence course. And
well, when I was in Barcelona, I started taking college courses again. And the only way that I could do it effectively through an American college was to go to one of these extension type programs. And there are a bunch of them popping up were starting to pop up all around the United States. So there was a place in New Jersey called Thomas Edison State College, which basically it's a credit bank where you take courses from any university, accredited university in the United States, or in fact around the world, and you send them the transcripts, and they bank it, and it comes from this state college. They don't offer any classes. At the time, they didn't even pick up their phone. It was in Trenton, New Jersey, and literally, I've never visited the place, but I'm really grateful for it.
Be cheer for its football team.
That's right. I wear the school colors religiously. Right. I wonder what the school colors even are. Anyway, so I was doing classes through this place called Thomas Edison State College, and got a degree, soup to nuts, 4 years, including books, for $10,000. That probably is a record, actually.
Right.
Who knows?
And it hasn't stopped you from having this career.
Yeah, not until today, when actually publicly everybody's just found out that I went to correspondence school.
Right. One other thing. A Harvard professor once told me that he did not plan to have any children, and he wasn't having any children, because he figured that every child would cost him a book. And he wanted to publish books rather than have children. Now, you have three children.
Yeah.
and you publish lots of books. So does actually having children inspire you to publish more books as opposed to the Harvard theory? This was an economist, by the way, at Harvard.
That's a good question. I do believe that the world will benefit more from my children than they will from my books. So if there is crowd out, it's okay. But there is a connection, actually, between kids and books. And it goes something like this. So my wife and I had two sons. As we put it euphemistically, biologically, right? Biological kids. And I was writing this book about charity. Okay. And in one of the chapters about charity, I was finding this weird thing in the data that shows that when people give to charity, their lives improve, but dramatically. And it's causal. They get healthier, they get happier, they even get richer. And there were reasons for it, and I wrote a whole chapter on it. And like always, everything I write, my wife reads. My wife, Esther, reads all the stuff that I write.
This is very wise.
Oh, yeah, for sure. No, and she spiked a lot of my stuff. Susan probably spikes your stuff, too, sometimes, right?
Right, and a couple of times when she hasn't, I wish she had.
Yeah, exactly. So I brought this chapter home that shows that giving and, you know, charitable actions make you healthy, happy, and rich. And she read through it. She ruminated on it for a while, and she said, you know, I think we ought to use the information in this book to change our lives a little bit.
Uh-oh.
I think we should give more. I said, okay, you know, write a check. You know, she said, no. I think we should adopt a baby. And I said, it's only a book.
It's only a theory.
That's right. If I realized somebody was going to take it seriously. And of course, I had no argument, so we did. And it was absolutely the best thing we ever did. It completely changed our lives. It inflected our lives in ways that we never could have expected. It was the most wonderful thing. And we actually adopted our daughter from China. And at the time, my wife wasn't a citizen, so she couldn't do the adoption. I had to go over alone to execute this whole adoption. I was over there for weeks. And they had never met a single man, a man by himself trying to adopt a baby. So everybody was really helpful. And generally, people would ask, did your wife pass away? And it was so hard doing the adoption that I basically said, no, but right now she's dead to me. But we got it done. It's been great. She's 8 years old. She dominates our family. She's the best.
Okay. The new book coming out on May 1st, The Road to Freedom.
Yeah.
Tell us why you wanted to write such a book.
As the president of the American Enterprise Institute, I have this great and lucky position to talk to a lot of people who are involved deeply in the political world and in the policy world. And one of the things that's been bothering me for several years is the fact that people who agree with my fundamental worldview, which is that free enterprise is the best system to improve the lives of the most people here in the United States and around the world, have failed to make the arguments that are most persuasive for it. It's horrible. And I was telling you that, you know, about the typical way that we just lose arguments. We lose arguments, stupidly lose arguments all the time, where, you know, you make this bulletproof case that the only way to bring our economy back is by lowering the corporate tax rate and having an effective fiscal consolidation plan, et cetera, et cetera. And your interlocutor, your debating partner says, yes, but I just met a little girl who lives with her mother in a car. Why don't you want the government to help her? And you lose the argument immediately, even though that's a completely dubious, anecdotal argument, and your argument has all the data behind it. Conservatives and free enterprise advocates have lost arguments for generations on the basis of this. And there's a tangible result of this. Mm-hmm. When my institution was founded in 1938, when the American Enterprise Institute was founded in 1938, it was because our founders believed that the government was taking up too big a chunk of GDP. That was when the government was taking up 15% of GDP, government at all different levels. Fast forward to 1980, 30%. When Ronald Reagan, the great government cutter, left office, 32%. When George W. Bush left office, 33%. Today, 36%. According to the Congressional Budget Office in 2038, 50%. In 2038, I mean, everybody here is going to be around in 2038, God willing. A lot of you are going to be in the hearts of your careers. And in 2038, you are going to work from January 1st to June 30th simply to pay for a government that you don't even like. What's going on? The answer is that's the road to serfdom. I mean, it's not the road to serfdom. It's not like a knock in the night and a jackbooted thug. It's one little compromise after another to the free enterprise system. And we're party to that because we haven't made the arguments that are compelling enough for Americans to say, no, that's enough. It's okay if I don't get my government-funded rec center and my midnight basketball and my free prescription drugs. You're the expert on this. You wrote about compassion. You were the authoritative voice about what compassionate conservatism actually means, and it doesn't mean more free stuff. But that's the direction that we're going, and we're losing the argument for a reason, and that had to stop as far as I was concerned. I wrote this book because people need the arguments that will actually win in the face of those trends.
And you write that the argument is often the moral left versus the materialistic right. That's the way it comes out. And that's deadly for the right.
It's a killer. It's an absolute killer. It's, when we talk about how when the President of the United States says that rich people just need to pay their fair share, which is why we need this crazy Buffett rule that won't raise any money, it's nothing more than a cudgel to try to act as if people of means in the United States had their money was ill-gotten for some class warfare reason. And if all the right can come back with is the fact that that would make the system less efficient and maybe cut a quarter percentage point off the net rate of economic growth, we're going to lose. If you think grandma is actually going to let Congressman Paul Ryan fiddle with her Social Security on the promise that her grandkids might get a slightly better mortgage rate? No way. The argument has to be moral. It has to be about fairness. It has to be about stealing from future generations. It has to be about our pursuit of happiness and getting in the way of entrepreneurs, getting in the way of the people that actually are trying to earn their success. And unless we can talk about what's written on our hearts about this system, we're not going to win, and I'm not sure we deserve to win.
But it's a great cudgel that Obama has right now. It's a very effective cudgel, and he's making the moral argument that millionaires should pay as much as secretaries pay, and that's the way it goes. We can come up with our calculations, and actually it would, as you say, it would hurt domestic production and so forth, but it seems to be pretty much an unbeatable political argument, right?
It's an unbeatable political argument if we accept his definition of fairness.
Fairness, okay.
This is the key. So what do we do? What do we do under the circumstances? When I talk to politicians who love free enterprise, they say, I just got to avoid the whole fairness argument. I said, that's wrong. No, take it on. The reason that the left wins the fairness argument is because we don't show up and we forfeit. When Obama talks about the Buffett rule and basic fairness, and it's only fair for millionaires and billionaires to pay their fair share, he's defining fairness as spreading the wealth. That's a fact. That's the wrong definition of fairness for 70% of Americans. 70% of Americans believe that true fairness means rewarding merit and creating an opportunity society, which is exactly what the free enterprise system is designed to do. The fairest system is one in which people actually have an opportunity to rise. They have a right to rise, and they're rewarded on the basis of their merit. Now, that doesn't mean they shouldn't have a safety net. But a safety net is not middle-class welfare. It's not spreading the wealth. It's not getting rid of risk in life. It's simply making sure that people don't have the most abysmal poverty and starve. That's not what Obama's talking about. Mm-hmm. Obama's talking about spreading the wealth around, and that's how he's defining fairness. If we want to take that on, and we can, we need to show up to the debate and say, Mr. President, you're defining fairness in the wrong way. We don't agree that spreading the wealth is fair. We think when people earn something, that they should be able to keep it, that spreading the wealth is actually unfair. And that argument is tremendously successful with a big majority of the population. The only reason we lose is if we're not courageous enough to make it.
So Patrick Henry students who get A's should voluntarily give 10 of their points, let's say, to raise up the students from D's to C's?
Yeah, I tried this. I tried. So I didn't have the great fortune to teach at Patrick Henry. I taught at a wonderful university, but one in which, suffice it to say, that my students were generally farther to the left. And I taught graduate students to boot. I taught microeconomics every semester. Inevitably, we got to the discussion of income inequality, and they would say it's not fair that some people have so much when other people have so little in a rich country, et cetera, et cetera. The arguments that you always hear over and over again. So we did a little experiment in my class. And the experiment was about halfway through the semester, you notice when you're teaching microeconomics, some people are getting it and some people aren't. I mean, a lot of you have taken micro. You know what I'm talking about. Now, it's not that the ones who aren't getting it are dumb. It's that they're not doing the work. It's you got to do the work. You have to study and you have to think about it and you have to do the exercises and the problem sets, etc. And everybody in the class knows that the ones who are doing poorly are simply not doing their homework. So everybody, even the ones who are not doing well know that. So about halfway through the semester, I'd say, I got a deal for you. I'm going to take the people who are in the top half of the class, I'm going to take a quarter of their points, and I'm going to give those to the people who are in the bottom half of the class. Why? Because I'm going to spread the wealth around. Now, every single person in the class, including the people who were getting C's and D's, knew that that was completely idiotic. They knew that that was a stupid idea. Why? Because it wasn't fair. And I said, see? That's what we're talking about in the economy here. That's what we're talking about. We're not talking about a minimum basic standard of living where people are starving. We're talking about looking at entrepreneurs and people who've taken great risks and people who've made great efforts and people who worked really hard to actually take away what they have simply because it's different than what other people have. That's as unfair as taking away the points that you've earned in your classes. And I think that in some number of cases, actually, it was persuasive. I may have won some souls.
But the story that reporters would tell, typically, when they get into questions of welfare and so forth, and there's some reality here. I mean, I've seen this myself all over the country. There are a lot of hardworking single moms who are very poor.
Right.
And they're stuck in their situation. And so isn't it heartless just to leave them in that situation? What would you propose for them?
I would propose a couple of different things. The first thing is first what Friedrich Hayek proposed. The greatest free market economist of the 20th century, arguably iconic on the political right, unimpeachable libertarian credentials. Friedrich Hayek said that there are two functions of government. One is to sort out market failures. The second is to create a minimum basic safety net. He said that, look, it might create a headwind on the economy, but a minimum basic safety net to prevent the most abject poverty, there's nothing wrong with that. That's actually a completely legitimate thing for the government to do, in the view of Friedrich Hayek, and in my view, too, number one. Number two, what are we called to do as individuals? What's written on our hearts, and what is our duty to our fellow men and women? Now, this is not just a question of those of us, all of us here, who happen to be Christians. It's about all the people who are of goodwill who share in the bounty of living in the greatest country in the history of the world. What are we going to do such that other people can earn their success? Look, we have a duty not just to lobby for more government welfare programs and pay our taxes. We have a duty to look out such that other people can live in an opportunity society and earn their success. That's the reason, incidentally, that free enterprise is so much harder than a welfare state, because it actually requires more of us in the way that we treat our fellow men and women. Truly, to live, to be a responsible individual in a free enterprise society requires more of us in the way that we treat the least among us, to speak in terms of Matthew 25, or to treat anybody else for that matter. It means being a good Samaritan in an entirely different and more intensive way, in my view.
And so when you're making the moral case for free enterprise, you're actually then calling on individuals to do a lot more than merely pay taxes happily or grudgingly. What do individuals need to do in order to make a free enterprise system work?
One of the things that conservatives have forgotten is something that Adam Smith knew. Now, Adam Smith, the most famous book he wrote was The Wealth of Nations in 1776. What many of you know, maybe some of you don't, is that 17 years earlier, in 1759, he wrote what he considered was his greatest work, which was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, that talked about a well-ordered society that could actually support the basic freedoms that would come to be constituted as what we know today as free enterprise. The Theory of Moral Sentiment said we need a healthy, ordered moral culture such that we can support what we know today as capitalism. If we don't have that, it's not going to work, is the basic idea. We have a huge duty to each other. If we believe in free enterprise, then we have a duty to each other to have a well-ordered society. And this well-ordered society has a whole bunch of pillars to it. The four main pillars are faith, family, community, and work. And if we actually can't have an idea of how these things interplay with each other, how we should share these things, how we should hold each other to high standards, how we should be good stewards of these things, then we're not going to get good capitalism. Good capitalism isn't going to serve us.
So how far can AEI, which again, for public policy, how far can AEI go and promote that? What are the limitations on what public policy can do? How can public policy help to enable people to act morally?
The American Enterprise Institute is dedicated to the free enterprise mission, which is to say we want proactively to create a better free enterprise environment. But the complement to that is advocating policies that don't do harm to a culture that facilitates healthy free enterprise that helps us all to earn our success. The first rule of government should be to do no harm to its citizens. That's the minimum basic standard, right? And the government's been doing tons of harm forever. So here's something that you and I have written about a lot, welfare, right? When I was a kid growing up in Seattle, we were basically poor. We grew up in a poor neighborhood. A lot of my neighbors were on welfare. The family next door, they were raising chickens in their living room, which at the time seemed normal to me. It turns out it's not. One of the things that we knew, you know, my dad taught during the year and drove a bus during the summer and worked real hard, and we did okay. And one of the things that we all knew was that welfare was hurting the poor. Everybody knew that. But politicians at the time, in the 1970s, said the problem with welfare is a colossal waste of money. Remember that?
Yeah.
Something changed when you and a few other scholars actually made this moral case in the mid-1980s. You said, the problem with the welfare system is not that it's a colossal waste of money. The problem with the welfare system is that it's hurting the people it's supposed to help. That's a profound moral distinction. That is to say, the government is hurting people instead of helping them. And worst of all, it's hurting the least among us. Now, if you know one moral thing, it should be don't go hurt poor people. If you don't know that, you were actually raised by wolves. You gotta know that. Right. And, you know, pointing that out was crucial. That was actually what lit the fuse toward welfare reform was the moral case. Mm-hmm. It wasn't even the economic case. And that's an example of what we need to advocate as an organization. What is the government doing that's hurting people, that's getting in their way, that's attenuating a healthy culture? Because if we can't say something about those things, we can't even get to the place where we can say that, yeah, the fundamentals of tax policy and entitlements and growth and jobs and et cetera, are going to lead to free enterprise that helps us all.
So let me push this a little bit then. Does AEI get into questions of family structure, single parenting, and the economic difficulties and the moral difficulties that causes? It's something different than usually goes on in public policy analysis, but right. As you've just been saying, you can't escape it because you need to make changes there or else nothing else is going to work.
It is. It's true. And we do. It's true. We do. The most popular book coming out of AEI this year is a book called Coming Apart by Charles Murray. It just spent 6 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. And in spite of that, it's actually a very good book. It's a book about how class in American society is creating a horrible set of barriers for people who are at the bottom of the socioeconomic spectrum in this country. It's a book about the fact that the top 5% in America and the bottom 20% in America don't understand each other, don't communicate with each other, and the biggest problem in the bottom 20% of society in America today is an unhealthy culture with respect to faith, family, community, and work. Culturally, not economically, there's a culture that goes against faith, family, community, and work. And when you have cultures that do violence to those things, you're going to have a dysfunctional community and people are going to stay poor. That's the single most influential piece of research that's coming out of AEI in 2012.
Okay. Now, your book, you talk a lot about earned success.
Yeah.
And that's a key concept, I think. If you could go into that a little bit and how that's different from just being successful or having a lot of money or things. The earning,
sure.
You're saying, is very important.
Yeah. You know, when one of the things that everybody, Patrick Henry, knows is that this country was based on a moral proposition, that we're endowed by our Creator with several unalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We know that. And since you're right here in Virginia, you know, actually, that those words were not entirely original. They actually were adapted from the Virginia Declaration of Rights, submitted 3 weeks earlier by George Mason. The interesting thing about the Virginia Declaration of Rights is that it didn't emphasize the pursuit of happiness. It emphasized the possession of property as one of the three moral promises. What happened in the 3 weeks between the Virginia Declaration of Rights and the submission of the Declaration of Independence? Nobody knows. There are stories that in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson talked about the fact that the possession of property was insufficiently moral to motivate a struggle, perhaps people dying for the greatest experiment in liberty in the history of the world. You can only imagine what those conversations were like. The bottom line is that it was a moral principle that came that brought this country into being, and it's a moral principle that we have to remember. That's the promise of our founders still to us today. That's, as far as I'm concerned, ethically what we owe future generations is to remember what that struggle really was all about. Now, what they meant when they said the pursuit of happiness is sort of the devil in the details, and I believe that what they meant was what we call earned success. Earned success is the belief that you're creating value with your life and value in the lives of other people. People who say that they have earned their success, and success is not money. You can define it in terms of, you can measure it in terms of money if you want, but it's not money per se. It's the value that you create with your life. And you can denominate it in souls saved or parks cleaned up or neighborhoods that are habitable or, you know, clean drinking water in sub-Saharan Africa or whatever, or lots of money if you want. You can measure it however you like, but it is earned success as a store of value that really motivates a whole lot of happiness. We have a lot of data on this. This is not a theory. As an empirical proposition, people who say that they have earned their success are the happiest people. It has to be earned, and it has to be something that you can measure in terms of the value that you're creating. When you have those things, you really have happiness by the tail. It's a wonderful thing to see. And so therefore, I believe as an ethical proposition, we need to be looking at our public policies for ways to make everybody, rich, poor, middle class, everybody, have the willingness and ability, the education, the opportunities to see earned success in their own lives. Does earned success mean a beautiful work of art? Does earned success mean having children who are productive and honest and have good values? Does it mean starting a business that creates jobs, opportunity, and growth? Does it mean what we're doing right here today? Maybe. That's our quest. Our ethical quest is to figure out what earned success means in each one of our lives and to facilitate it in the lives of other people.
Now, do evangelicals sometimes have a hard time with that concept? Because when we think theologically, we tend to think of unearned success in the sense of God's grace.
Sure.
Completely apart from our own worthiness or lack thereof, because we are all unworthy of it. So here we're thinking one way economically, but when it comes to thinking in the larger terms of theology, we tend to emphasize grace. I'm wondering if President Obama or Jim Wallis take grace and apply that to the government and say the government should be gracious to all by redistributing property.
I think they do, in fact, think that way. And I think that the biggest objection that we should have is that they have just substituted the government for God.
Right.
Very dangerous thing to do. And it's happened a lot throughout history, and it's never ended well.
Right. But even George W. Bush said, when people are hurting, government's got to move. How do your arguments, now you've debated Jim Wallis, I've debated Jim Wallis. I mean, do your arguments work with Jim Wallis and other folks on the Christian left? Do they get it? And if not, how do you communicate?
Do they land? Does the punch land with Jim Wallis? Hard to say. We'd have to ask Jim, I think. But I think that they're persuasive enough that they're hard to rebut. I think that even evangelical Christians who believe very strongly that everything proceeds from God's grace know that we are as dutiful children of God have a lot that we need to do, that there's a lot of effort that we need to make, that there is a lot of virtue that we need to model, that there's a lot that we need to earn effectively. And so the whole idea that, of course, we act meritoriously and whether or not God bestows graces on us is his business, there's nothing antithetical to the concept that our struggle, that we should behave virtuously and that we should work hard.
Yeah, we do sometimes tend to mix that up, though.
Sure.
And I'm wondering about another mix-up. The one of the things, as we learn from the Bible, about our total depravity, our inability by ourselves to do what is good in God's sight. Now, Jim Wallace and others would say in many ways that man is naturally good and corrupted by particular institutions such as capitalism. How do we communicate with them if we're really coming from different presuppositions? Do you have to get to those presuppositions? And again, I admire your book and the emphasis on earned success and as a way of what the pursuit of happiness involves. But I just wonder if it gets to the basic presuppositions, and therefore if it's going to be effective in dealing with people on the left.
Philosophically, it's really hard to deal with people who believe, as Rousseau did, that we're born good and that we're naturally corrupted. That's a little bit in conflict with the whole concept of original sin, I dare say. I'm no theologian.
But you're right.
So it's a little bit at odds. Unfortunately, the whole concept that we can dignify ourselves by creating an opportunity society, defining our happiness, and pursuing it through meritorious action, it accords entirely with common sense. There are very few people who think, that's all a bunch of nonsense, that if you work harder, you'll do well. I mean, who thinks that? I mean, there aren't very many people who actually believe that. The only way that you can think that merit doesn't matter is if you have tenure at a university. I think that's pretty much the only, or be a French bureaucrat, maybe. I think that's kind of it. You know, I've had tenure. Let me tell you, it's great. I think that there aren't very many people of common sense, left, right, or center, that just don't believe in merit, that don't believe that hard work matters. Now, does it matter entirely? No, there actually is some luck in life. And some people are born with fewer opportunities. But once again, this is one of the ethical callings of those of us who believe in the free enterprise system. This is the reason the free enterprise system is harder work than the welfare state, is because we have to recognize the ways that our opportunity society fails and take it upon ourselves to try to rectify those failures. What are we going to do, for example, for the civil rights nightmare that is public education in America today? We have public school systems that exist, whole public school systems that exist for the benefit of grown-ups and not kids. What are we doing about that today? Because if we don't, then we're abdicating our responsibility as people who believe in an earned success society. It's much easier to just check into the welfare state and say, the government ought to do more about this. Paying my taxes, it's all good. That's actually not enough for those of us who believe in free enterprise. The ethical standard is, I think, higher.
Yeah, let me ask one more pushing question. Can we really talk about morality without referencing God? I was mentioning upstairs that Arthur's new book is a little bit like the Book of Esther, in that God, the name of God is not there. God is not a visible character. Now, he's the invisible hand in some ways, and he certainly suffuses the Book of Esther. But I'm wondering, how far can you go, how deep can you get in a book that really doesn't talk about God? What kind of morality is there apart from God?
I think that there is, as I dare say we all believe, God is in every single thing. The morality of God is in every single thing as well, stated or unstated. Will it be less effective if God is not stated explicitly? No, actually, I think in some cases it'll be more effective.
Okay.
And the reason I think it'll be more effective in certain cases is because, in point of fact, we need a secular conversation that talks about moral virtues. We need that. We need that in a country where we can have a conversation between people who believe and people who don't believe. We need to be able to talk about virtue and values across sectarian lines and in between communities of those of us who are Christians and those who aren't. And if we can't talk about morals except in the absence of God, then what we're effectively saying is that people who don't share our religious views have these values conversations foreclosed to them. That's, I think, a little dangerous, and I think it's actually not accurate.
That was author and former American Enterprise Institute president Arthur Brooks speaking with World's Marvin Olasky. This interview took place in 2012 at Patrick Henry College. If you enjoyed this podcast, would you take a moment to rate and review the program? It's quick and easy. Just click on the 5 stars in the app you're using to rate it, or you can go a step further and write a review. We're grateful to all of you who have already done so. Thank you for listening to this presentation of listener-supported World Radio. I'm your host, Jill Nelson. See you next time.
The Olasky Interview is made possible by listeners like you. Additional support comes from Crown and Covenant Publications, publisher of the new book, God Breathed, by Rutt Etheridge III. For truth seekers in the age of the lonely self, this book will help you connect through Scripture to God, others, the natural world, and yourself. Available at crownandcovenant.com and on audiobook platforms.